as young people at Stellenbosch University. But also, it's also about, to some extent, engaging with those aspirations and not treating them simply as objects which I, as the expert, spout out theories of race and tell them what race is, which I think is quite deeply problematic. I mean, particularly teaching a course about that race. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about, just provide a brief outline, as brief as possible, of the course I teach and some of the kind of topics and issues we look at. And then focus particularly on some activities, participatory activities, and ideas about race which are produced through these activities. And the course, as you can see that, I'll just read through it very quickly. I think that what the course tries to do is to, in a way, to develop an idea of race, and this is my own kind of notion of race, because I can't almost work in a vacuum. I have to think quite clearly about how I'm thinking about race and what informs this course. And I'm trying to elicit their views of race, the students' views of race, but also I need to be very clear about what my own view of race is. And I guess that I'm very critical of the idea of thinking about race as something one has, something which one possesses, something which determines your views and identities, etc. But rather, I want to think about race, and this is partly because through political activity and also through reading sociological theory, philosophy, etc., that I see race much more as something which people do, process of classifications like gender as well, actually, and something which is constructed, which is produced. Historically, it was produced, of course, there's no biological basis to race, that race didn't exist prior to to colonization, slavery, not in the popular ways that we think about and construct it today. And there weren't any white people in Britain prior to the 17th century. There weren't any black people in Africa prior to the 17th century. Race was relationally produced through colonization and through slavery. And if there is, there's a kind of strong critical tradition of thinking about race along those lines. But at the same time, I also want to think about race as something which is constructed and produced through everyday forms of interaction in the here and now. Yes, it was produced under colonialism, and yes, it was institutionalized and codified under apartheid. And we look at the history of race in South Africa, and taking race as a verb all the time. How it was produced. What did apartheid do to kind of produce race? And how did the laws produce race, rather than taking for granted that race is something that's kind of fixed, and simply concentrating, if you like, upon the inequalities in race. That's important, but also it's important is the very concept of race itself. What actually is it? So I'm working with the idea that race is a verb, okay? And that kind of structures the way that I'm sort of presenting. And that allows, I think, the possibility of developing a participatory approach with young people, which is about how to really run their constructions of race and their identifications in relation to race. So in a way, to move my cards on the table a bit there, I asked in the beginning, if you were to describe race and alien from another planet, what would you say? I use the term alien all the time. It's a bit problematic, alien, but I say friendly alien, okay? And then getting an idea of an outside and just never experienced race before. How do you describe it? I do that straight away and in the class and it's a mass lecture theatre, and then people come and I get them to write it out, how to describe race. And then it's quite a lot of work because I have to go back and 450 people write these things in and can only take a small sample, of course, and then go through it and identify some of the key themes which emerge in terms of how they... And I'm going to talk about that in a minute because that's a very interesting participatory activity. And it starts right at the beginning of the course, which is interesting, okay? Starting from where they're at, if you like. So how to describe that? And if you ask what race you were, not taking race for granted. Note these questions. Not taking race for granted. Say, if you were asked this, what would you say? It's opening up the possibility. Second session is a session around drawing upon the video some of you might have come across it before. So it's experiment, social experiment. You know, you had it with someone called Jane Elliott, who pioneered this in the United States, and she was teaching in the southern states of America, and it was a time when Martin Luther King got shot, and she was appalled at the way in which the media were kind of talking to black community leaders, how are you going to control your people, as if they're other, as if they're completely different, almost subhuman. And she decided, she's teaching this all-white school, so she wanted to try and encourage the white children she was teaching to sort of empathize with black people and understand their experience of discrimination. But how could she do that? So what she did was almost create race in her class, or tried to do that, by taking eye color as a marker of difference, and then starting to treat people with blue eyes and brown eyes very differently. She actually got the brown eyed kids to put a collar over them so you could really see their brown eyes. And she said, "Oh, God, you're so stupid. Look at that. Yeah, she's doing this. She's doing it, scratching her ear. She's not listening at all. She's so boring." And then other people, you look really, because you've got blue eyes. And found that very quickly, that these young people started to develop identifications around eye colour. And then she gave the blind kids extra recess, they favoured them, and the brown eyed kids less recess. And when they were out in the playground, they started actually insulting each other, using not racial insults in terms of skin colour, but racial insults in terms of eye colour. Okay? And then even in class, the kids, the brown eyed kids who were seen as inferior race, they started to perform worse. There was a special group, and they performed worse in various tasks than the black kids. So this is very important, and the students really, really are into this. They find it absolutely mind-blowing. And particularly, what I'm interested in doing is trying to make the connection that Jane Elliott tries to do between, between eye colour, if you like, and skin colour. And that race, there's no bar, but suddenly this superficial difference, eye colour, which no one had given a toss about before, suddenly becomes a key source of identification and also a key dimension of power and inequality. Okay? That sort of minds depend within the context of a society, if you like, the classroom, upon whether they've got blue eyes or brown eyes. And in the same way, trying to get across the notion, perhaps, that race has no biological reality. Yes, of course, when you ask 10 minutes, okay. I'll get onto this in a minute, okay. Wait, because I'm going to talk more about the activity, but it's really, really good, okay. So, I've got something to really look forward to. So, session 1, 2, session 3, I then go on to look at sociological understandings of race and how, and the work that's been done. Sociological and historical figures around understandings of how race was produced under colonialism and slavery, and the kind of not that it was already there, but that how it was kind of produced and constructed relationally. This sense that race is not an essence, it's not something fixed, it's not something we have which makes us behave in certain ways, but rather it's something we do, and it's quite a challenge for me to talk about it because cross races. I'm white and you're black and I mean surely it's inscribed in skin colour but it's about the symbolic significance, of course, which we attach to these markers. Why do they become markers of difference and how does that happen? So I just want to. Stuff around history. I know the questions, why are there no black people in South Africa prior to colonization? So the questions are designed in a way to kind of frame, to kind of think about race in critical ways. Skin is a brilliant movie. I don't know if any of you've seen it, but to talk about, around ideas about apartheid, partly it's about a woman, Sandra Lang, who was born into a white Afrikaans family, and she was actually classified as coloured. She looked coloured. She was classified as coloured. And it's all about, and the way I kind of, people are very, you get very engaged in it, but what I'm trying to do is to kind of frame, the viewing of it in terms of, how is she being socially constructed under apartheid? She's a figure that doesn't fit into the apartheid categories. And how is she being treated by other people? How does she become constructed as the other? That's the way in which I sort of kind of address apartheid, and I think one of the things about this is that opens up your possibilities for thinking, if you like, beyond race, you know, and I mean, working, I guess, drawing upon ideas of you know, the Freedom Charter in the 1950s about a possibilities of a non-racialized society, one which doesn't depend upon the idea of race, and the sense that maybe what actually is race, well, perhaps is to do with you know, kind of constructing people, categorizing people as if they belong to different species, and then that notion of that as if, you know, that has actually materialities because people are treated very differently, and so you know they used to become, if you like, different species in terms of how they're treated and how they're constructed. But it's not, you know, but there's no biological basis for that. And that's important. It's opening up the possibilities of thinking kind of beyond race. And it's something which students find very engaging and actually kind of, and that crosses race divides as well, in ways of kind of talking about apartheid, as well as, you know, inequality about it. I've got time, but then we go on to looking at Stellenbosch University and ideas about race and gender and transformation at the university. And again, trying to kind of think about ways of engaging with this in very student-centered ways, participatory ways. I mean, part of the readings I've drawn here are extracts from research which students themselves conduct, which I'm supervising, other people are supervising, in the residences, for example. And looking at institutional practices which are aimed at promoting social cohesion, but which often end up, you know, marginalising people. I mean, one of my arguments, is that the transformation needs to be informed by research with different and diverse students and how they construct and experience, you know, the university. It's too serious an issue to be left to senior management, and also, looking at the ways in which transformation is kind of understood and in relation to theories of race and you know, what do we mean by transformation? Is it just about race? Is it, you know, about other things? And if it is about race, then what is it about race? Is it just about numbers? Is it about where does social cohesion come into this? You know, and all the concepts like diversity, social cohesion, which instead of taking, because I think, you know, one of the problems is they're often kind of taken for granted in ways which kind of curtails critical thinking and also leads to quite antagonistic attacks, you know, and insular kind of identifications around certain understandings. So what I'm going to do, because how much time I've got, actually?
You've got another 8 minutes.
Right, so what I'm going to do, I won't go through the rest of the course, but I just want to talk about more about the activities, some of the activities. So the first one, exploring social and race through students' engagement activities. So reflecting on new race. So this is the first one, which I mentioned, about some, you know, if you were to describe race and alien from another planet, what would you say? And so, you know, I looked through all these, you know, kind of about, you know, 20, 30 of them, you know, the night after they did this, and then I sort of did a brief analysis, you know, of some of these. So some people said, you know, it's a quote, you know, race is something that binds you to a group. These were very common ones. Binds you to a group, and each race is unique in history, beliefs, and relations. People who look different from one another, groups according to tradition, culture, background, mainly segregated by physical attributes. It's a visual way to see which culture someone belongs. So I went to, you know, just the three of them. I went into this class and said, really angry. You know, I said, I'm a famous academic. You know, I'm a brilliant researcher on race. And I've been paid a lot of money to teach you about race. And you don't even know what race is. I'm not simply asking you for a definition. We have to start with a definition before we can begin, you know, to talk about it, to debate it. This is outrageous. And I just walked off, you know, and then I said, you know, it's something that binds, oh God, this is so stupid. I mean, I didn't, you know, mention any names, of course, you know, it's not about naming, shaming. Well, I did, actually, I'm just joking. But binds you to a group. I said, well, what is it then? What binds you to a group? Is it glue? You know, is it, what is it? Is it sticking plaster? And I asked people, and there was a dead silence, and that got me really, really angry. And people look different from the book, maybe they're according to tradition, culture, background, maybe. What is this? This is garbage. It's a visual way to see which culture someone belongs to. What do you mean by culture? And eventually, then skin color came up a lot. You know, some people said a race is not being, it's a variance in skin color, and some, you know, talk about black and colored and white. What do you mean? Okay. So, and they said, but why am I white? Okay. Is that me? Yeah, I've got blue lines through it, but okay. But, yeah, so I think one of the things that this did, I mean, in sort of thinking about what kind of concept of race are they using here to structure the ways they think about themselves and other people, it's almost like the idea that race produces who you are. You know, race is something which is, it's not, you know, that's what it is, okay? And it's a way of, and again, what I'm doing here is phrasing it in terms of verb, okay? It's something that's done. Not a sexual thing, but that's how they construct. It's one way of thinking about it. Race is something fundamental. It produces who you are, okay? And one of the ways I think a really good pedagogic approach to take when you're teaching race is actually to be funny, and partly because humor. I mean, humor has got a lot of people when they're writing about the course of evaluation said they kind of quite liked it because it was funny. And partly because, you know, they said it's difficult, you know, it's like walking on eggshells, but humour makes it less like that. And I think that's one reason. But also, I think, you know, there's an absurdity to race, absurdity of the categories, the very categories of race. And I think, you know, to do justice to the absurdity of race, you have to be funny. You can't not be funny, you know. So I produced something like this, you know. I said, wow, you know, it's really interesting. What does this say? And I didn't realise that the toilet's only for white people, you know. And then people, it's not that, you know. And being a friendly outsider. Well, that's what you're saying. You said, why is that? You just said that, you know. And that also actually introduced, you know, she's a non-gender, of course, I use really powerful examples from research, again, this thing about participatory research and implications for education. I used to teach at the University of Queensland in Natal, and I edited a book there with a friend, which was about, called Undress in Durban, and basically we wanted articles from people about how they kind of experienced kind of Durban and constructed it, and many students and staff. And three of the most interesting articles were autobiographical pieces by people who were outsiders in the sense that they'd come to University College of Natal from other countries. And suddenly they became aware of being racialized in certain ways, which they'd never experienced before, in terms of the kind of four categories, you know, the apartheid categories, black, white, colour, Indian. So Wesley, for example, at the top of the work, Michael Wesley Oakes, he writes his piece, I'm an African and not a coloured. He's from Canada, his father is black, his mother's white, and he always identified as African or black. And when he came to, he imagined that when he came to Durban, you know, that he would probably have quite a lot of, you know, black friends and hoped he'd have some white friends as well. But no one who was black approached him. And he found that was really weird. And white people didn't really approach him either. And the people who did approach them identified as coloured. And so it's kind of a really powerful way, I think, of providing insights into the kind of taken for granted in terms of lens that people use, you know, to kind of identify with other people, distance themselves from other people, etc. And I think, you know, the one of the, and certainly in the course we talk about it, we talk about the sort of the legacy of apartheid, and part of the legacy of apartheid is the tendency to think along racial lines, and which can be quite problematic because it can exclude possibilities of friendships and close down certain things. And certainly, again, you know, some really interesting, you know, writing around these things. I'm going to see the other ones, but this is very powerful. And again, you know, part of the kind of absurdity of race, you know, so I kind of did thing, why did Wesley Oakes discover he wasn't black, and he reminded, you know, did he get it, was the multi-choice question, did he get the new mirror, he got sick in the flight and his family landed there, perhaps she tempted Norma, any collision threat, etc. Okay, realising. And then race is absurd, but also race is painful, okay, and it's no good just laughing at it. And that's one thing I think we need to hold on to. But also, the idea of race being very painful came out. And this is certainly something which emerged when people were talking about, you know, the reactions to the Sandra Lang movie. skin, this girl who looked coloured and was actually classified as coloured under apartheid, born to a white family. They sent her to a white boarding school. When she went to this white boarding school, she was ridiculed and abused by teachers because she was a coloured girl. And it's based on a true story. And there's a lot of pain, and people felt a great deal of pain about that. So this idea, I think that the two are really important to hold on together. Saying that you can't laugh at race, you can't treat it in an absurd way because it's so painful, is very problematic, and vice versa too. That the two need to be holding together. And I think this other thing, when it comes to understanding the dynamics of race, it really helps be an alien. One thing I used to say about the absurdity of race, you probably don't know who this incredibly good-looking guy was, but it's actually me, again, it's very easy to tell. About a couple of years ago, that's not me, it's the one there, and it's the dog, okay, that's not me. And so I used to talk about pencil tests. Now, people might find this quite offensive and things, but I would refer the pencil test. Sandra Lang's a wonderful illustration. The pencil test, in the movie where her father's trying to get her reclassified as white, and she fails the pencil test, if you put a pencil, it would get lost in my hair. Whereas now I would pass with flying colours. And again, the absurdity in some ways of it. To humour as compared, how long have we got? Just 2 minutes, okay, that's fine. In a way that the humour is about playing around with and subverting categories, which normally we would rarefy and take for granted. And the reputation of race through racialized. One of the things, again, so thinking about the kind of relevance, if you like, to race today, because often when people talk about race, it's sometimes one of the common discourses about why race is something which ended with the ending of apartheid, and certainly it's a common discourse, I think, here at Stellenbosch. And what I do is to introduce students to the concept of racialization, which I think is very, very powerful. Racialization kind of means, and it sounds like sociological jargon, it is jargon, but it's good jargon, and it's about trying to explain, if you like, the significance of race, or think about the significance of race in post-apartheid South Africa. Certain race under apartheid, of course, certain spaces, certain peoples and bodies became racialized through legislation, through law. But the idea of racialization is how is it that certain spaces become imbued with race, become thought of along race lines, when there aren't any laws to do that? And people, just asking students to map spaces on campus, are there certain spaces which are outside campus, are there spaces, and there's some of the literature I draw on as well about from other universities which I've been involved with, people have written about stories about going to nightclubs, for example, in Durban and in Cape Town, and nightclubs which are seen as white, and some nightclubs seen as coloured, and some of that. And the students are very familiar with that. They've got a very good map, if you like, of Stellenbosch in terms of race, and they find that very easy to identify. But then you ask, well, why is it white? And you said it's white music. Does it kind of does white smoke come out of the music or what? No! I said, well, what does come out? Why is it white? I need to know. One of the problems about asking those kind of questions is that people feel that they're being racist. By putting those kind of questions to them, then you're implying that they're going to these places, so they don't want to mix with black people and colored people, etc. But, of course, it's much more complex than that. It's not that at all, in a sense. They'd be born and brought up, and you listen to this kind of music, and you're used to living in certain places. In a culture and society which still is quite racialized, and this raises questions about the contemporary significance of race in South Africa. And this is very, very popular. Getting people to do these mapping exercises and think about what makes music white, or what makes music black, etc. And are there examples of people who cross over the divide? And what's that like? And that's really, really interesting. I know you can read it, so just finish off with one last example. And this is a talk we did right at the beginning the first talks we did. There's five talks altogether. And basically, we asked people to split into pairs, and preferably, didn't mention race, but just mentioned, preferably someone who you don't know at all, and from a completely different background, if possible. And then interview this person for 15 minutes. You start up interviewing this person. Ask some questions about, we want them to have some kind of structure, so ask some questions about why they came to Stellenbosch, something about their interests, and what they like and dislike about sociology, okay? So, you know, something that we could have in common. But we mentioned, I spoke about it as, I'm really keen you do what are called semi-structured interviews. Quite a nice, actually, introduction too to search methods. And by semi-structured, I mean you have certain themes you want to cover, but you're particularly interested in making it as conversational as possible. You want to pick up on issues which the person you're interviewing raises, and then ask them questions around those issues. And it's kind of research I do quite a bit. And then after 15 minutes, they'll swap around, okay? So, and the other person, you'd be interviewed by the other person. Then to write up the research, write up a bit about, well, what did you find out from the other person in terms of some of the questions you asked. But also to write about what was it like interviewing the other person? What kind of relationship did you establish with the other person? Did the dynamics of the relationship change in the process of doing the interview? If so, how did that happen? What kind of emotions were conveyed, etc.? And what we found was that, you know, a lot of people did, you know, take the leap, if you like, and interviewed people from different race backgrounds and different gender backgrounds as well. And one of the key themes emerged from this was how surprised people were. And you know, this kept on coming up again and again. At sort of how they're able to talk, you know, without even thinking about it very much to other people, and how that, you know, how surprised they were that these kind of conversations were ones which were, you know, just like interviewing anyone else, you know, that's such a powerful, I think, finding, if you like, from that research, why is it so surprising, you know, and sort of suggests, you know, the possibilities of breaking down forms of racialized relationships. Just one thing to finish off, I mentioned the thing about the idea of race equaling race thinking. You know, the sense in which this interpretive lens, you know, through which you see the world, greatly affects, you know, how you identify yourself and others. But one of the dangers of that approach, which is really interesting, because it came up in a kind of conversation between black students, white students, all students were quite engaged with that idea. But one thing that came across was this idea that we should stop thinking about race, you know, because if we stop thinking about it, then that's the problem. Is to do with race thinking, as a form of race. But then, you know, and some black students particularly were kind of quite critical of that, saying that, well, you know, that how do we address racial inequalities? You know, how do we engage with redress if we don't have a concept? It's like pulling the rug from under your feet. And I think that really complexifies the issues, and it raises questions about, you know, what are the material and cultural influences which encourage forms of race thinking. You know, why is it that people that it's not just irrational, and that's why it's so important, I think, to hold on to, you know, these different ways, you know, we're thinking about race as a material reality. And so we looked at Stellenbosch, we looked at interviews conducted with kids in Kyamandi, you know, grade 12 kids in Kyamandi, research which I conducted with someone else, and about asking them, you know, they live in Stellenbosch, only 15 minutes away from the university. Do they see Stellenbosch University as a resource? Do they imagine coming to Stellenbosch? And most of them didn't. You know, what most of them said was Afrikaans. You know, they wouldn't be able to cope here because they couldn't speak the language. But then I was interviewing, and I think they were saying things in a way they didn't want to offend me. You know, I teach at Stellenbosch, they knew that, and a white person as well. But I was working with a black teacher, a black American woman actually, who was very close to them, and she asked a question about, well, how do you think you'd find, you know, the social life here at Stellenbosch? You know, what do you think about that? And one person, you know, started to say, almost very apologetically, that he would feel quite intimidated, and kept on saying, you know, that I'm sorry, but I went to the lab, but, you know, and it feels very, very white. And you spoke, you introduced the idea of race, and sort of, you know, almost like it's again, you know, the idea that race becomes materiality, you know, and I think it's very, very important, you know, to hold on to the idea of race and materiality, as well as to hold on to the idea that race, we need to interrogate race thinking as well, you know. And so anyway, just leave it for now.
Thank you very much. Okay, any questions, any discussion points? I'm sure a lot of issues have been raised for people.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Trevor Noah.
All right, yeah.
So he's playing with it as well, and he's also joking about it. Sometimes it just feels uneasy the way he does it. One of the criticisms, or one of the things I hold against him, is that he often takes gender then as the thing that you can be, or you would make fun of women, you know, objectify women of different races, and he's sort of the male gaze, so he's quite good at sort of relativizing race, but then this other problem crops up for me of the objectification of women while doing that. Do you ever use him? Do you discuss him? Is he well known amongst the students?
He is, and some students more than others, and people actually have made, you know, that point and said, you know, or you must look at this, you know, Trevor no video and things. You're thinking, I like, and I do actually think he's very clever and a brilliant comedian. But also, I have mixed feelings, you know, along some of the lines that you've articulated about it. I mean, he made this very, very powerful, you know, observation, I think, in my view, about the Oscar Pistorius case, you know, and almost like, I think one of the things that was hidden, which helps to make sense of what Oscar Pistorius was talking about, was race. You know, and often I think there's another way actually that we can think about race, something which is unarticulated and like almost like the elephant in the sitting room. Kevin Durham and others kind of write about that in a book called Race Trouble that they've written. And I think, you know, he sort of talked about, you know, that he compared, you know, what happened to Oscar Pistorius, what happened to Jujub, you know, the rap master, and who got, he was racing around, you know, township and killed, you know, some young people and got sent to jail, I think, for 20 years or so. And yet, you know, Oscar Pistorius, who, you know, intentionally shot a gun, you know, into the bathroom, claiming there was an intruder, and the idea of the intruder, you know, is sort of deconstructed by a number of writers that the intruder implementations being, you know, a kind of a black person, you know, and from a township called Black Person, and that his wife is seen as negligible, you know, compared to. So I think, you know, for the double standards and things, and comedians like Trevor Noah, yeah, that their comedy depends upon, you know, making these kind of sharp observations, I think, and that's very powerful. But I think that's a really good point. You know, I think it's really interesting actually to talk about humour in education and how humour is used in very different ways, because it can be used in very repressive ways actually, in ways to please people. And you know, I'm trying to think of productive ways of using it.
I guess the question is whether satire objectifies or whether it reveals someone else's objectification. Whether it reveals society, or whether is it a cause of the objectification,
yeah,
or is it a mirror of societal objectification? And I think in his case, for example, I experience it differently, maybe because I'm a man, I don't know. But I'm a feminist too. It's possible. I think we have to distinguish between whether he's objectifying or it is mirroring or revealing the objectification.
On this point, you know, I often wonder to what extent does comedy need to be explained to people, and saying that you know, it may not be explicitly so, but this is what I'm saying. Because you have people who look up to Trevor Noah who might not have a level of understanding of what is happening there. And then you have people like, for example, Steve Hoffmeyer, who would say, you know, after the breaking there was the stench in the room, and how many people would understand what he's saying, and how many people would understand. So there's danger in either way in not quite explaining what someone like Trevor Noah might be meaning, even though it is a comedian, and on a certain level you understand what he's saying and why he's saying it, but on another level there are implications for people who perhaps don't have that kind of understanding.
I think that's a really, really good point, actually, yeah, because and often, you know, that if you explain it, the comedians are not supposed to explain their jokes, you know,
yeah.
and because being funny, if you explain it, then it's not so funny, in a way. And that's a really good point. I mean, I used to do stand-up comedy a bit, and sometimes, you know, I thought that what I was trying to communicate was being misinterpreted, and I got really worried about that, actually.
Yeah.
So there's an obligation, I think, you are going to use humour as a teaching approach, that then you to kind of explain things and relate it very much to what you're doing.
I think maybe. I'm in the law faculty, and I mean, one of the frustrations I have the last year is teaching affirmative action as part of equality, because it's part of the constitution and so forth, but with black students being such a small minority and black in the critical mass in the class, we don't have to constantly in the position of having to say, look, it's not reverse discrimination, it's about redress and historical redress and so forth, but it would be much more powerful if there were more black students with a different group. I'm not saying they would all have the same perspective on it, but it would just be. And it really is, year after year, I feel pedagogically it's a real challenge not having, you know, like sufficient critical mass of black students to articulate a different perspective.
I think that's a really good point, actually. One of the kind of encouraging things, actually, certainly in sociology, that over the last two or three years, the proportion of black students has increased quite rapidly, you know, and what it's like when I first started teaching. I noticed it, the kind of the importance of this when I invited a couple of students I'm supervising who are doing research in residences, both from college students, they're doing research on how students, different type of students, experience residence life and to report on their findings. And I sort of interviewed them a bit, and then they presented their papers. And one of the things someone called Megan Robinson, who I supervised, wrote a brilliant master's thesis. And one of the things that emerged from her conversations was how some students, particularly black students and coloured women students, experienced marginalisation through Scarfing, the institutional practice of scarfing. I don't know if you know it's called scarfing. It's a kind of social event, you know, where usually, you know, single-sex female residents or single-sex male residents will invite the other residents along for a kind of social gathering. And it's quite formalised as well. So, you know, the men, you know, stand on one side and women stand on the other side. It's quite important to report, and the men are supposed to take the first move. So it's very, you know, kind of racist in a way. It's the men to take the first move. But also what one number of black and coloured women students have complained about is a sense of marginalisation, because although they're not overtly racist or anything, you know, they're consent high and things, then they'll pass by and sort of make a beeline for white women students. So something which is supposed to be a kind of a ritual which is supposed to, you know, promote social cohesion in a residence, you know, a kind of social event, ends up marginalising black students and coloured students. And also, it's highly, of course, heteronormative as well, you know, which is another thing which doesn't get talked about very much. Megan was reporting on the research, and afterwards, after the session, loads and loads of people came up onto the stage, you know, to embrace Megan and to thank her, you know, for making those comments. And obviously, if I'd done that, you know, it wouldn't happen to me. And so well, you never know, but I mean, I think it does, you know, indicate the importance of, you know, all what you're saying.
Yeah.
One of the things I noticed at Stellenbosch was there's often an uncomfortableness or silence in talking about race. So I was wondering about your presentations. Do you think that the messenger would play a role if a black person had to present this course that you did? Would it make a difference? And then also, would if it's not presented, then pedagogy of humor, how do you think would it be received?
I think those are really good questions, actually, yeah. And I'm sure it would. You know, I'm just thinking about Open Stellenbosch, actually, in this context. You know, that which made, you know, I think, well, raised very important issues about particularly around the language policy and the marginalisation. I mean, based on the search they've done, you know, with members of the group, but also linking with other research being done on with students in campus. I mean, there's the ACT report a few years ago, which also raised concerns about this and about problems that students experience in classes where the lecturers code switch between Afrikaans and English, and how the code switching often, you know, results in speaking Afrikaans and the kind of feelings of marginalization and isolation experienced by those students. Now because that's presented by, you know, and I know that there's been a lot of criticism of Open Stellenbosch on the grounds that it's taking a particular racialized view, a particular racialized mind, and that it's kind of excluding other people. I don't particularly see that, you know, from the materials that they're producing. I mean, if you read through the set of complaints, you know, which they took to the director, the ones which, it's not about saying eradicate Afrikaans or anything like that. It's simply about saying, well, you know, we come to this university in good faith. You know, we expect that we're going to understand the lectures. You know, we want to belong to this university. We want to feel a sense of belonging. And I think because it's constructed as a black movement, and most of the people who are part of it are black, then it gets seen as you know, they've got a kind of, you know, drum to beat in a way. Whereas there's been lots of really interesting research actually about some. The power and privilege of whiteness, not necessarily in the sense of economic power, though, you know, that's obviously important, but in the sense of becoming invisible a bit, you know, and being seen as a spokespeople for the wider society, if you like, whereas black people get lumped with being, you know, it happens quite a lot, I think, you know, get, as having a racial access for us, whereas white people don't.
The bigger picture where we fit in is also important, because if I attend international conference and I'm introducing myself, I'm an African, they all believe I'm making a joke.
Right.
So it's the sins of the father. So because of my appearance, I could never be identified as an African. And that's the only thing I know for more than 500 years. So this whole thing about putting labels on people, that's how the world looks at us. So you can't ignore the fact that they won't see me as an African.
No, I mean, I think this, again, is a really, really good point you're raising that. The labels aren't just, you know, kind of accidental, superficial, you know, they're kind of quite rooted in certain ways of thinking and categorizing people. And so claiming an African identity as a white person often seems quite strange and problematic. And yet, you know, it's precisely this playing around with categories that in a way is one of my aims, I guess, in the course, you know, not to take categories as essentialist, you know, not to see them as being rooted in nature, but as things that are constantly being constructed and negotiated. And I think the notion of African, I think it's, if you think about an African university, for example, you know, how can we I think there's a Mbembe, a cultural theorist from Cameroon, was here in Stellenbosch 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I think, you know, gave a very powerful talk about how he envisaged a public university, okay, as opposed to a white Afrikaans university or an ex-white Afrikaans university. What does that mean, a public university? And he was talking about the kind of almost the importance of relevance. You know, that knowledge, you know, needs to be relevant, needs to be help to make sense of the realities we're living, but also one where race becomes less significant as a form of identification and difference. You know, so public university shouldn't be one which is kind of racialized. I mean, it should be one where there's sort of a kind of common identification along certain lines. I mean, African could provide that, you know, but it's also quite contested as well, of course, and particularly, I guess in the history, you know, the painful history of apartheid, etc. It's difficult to negotiate in a way. I mean, do white people have the right to make this claim, you know, and given, you know, the continuation of material inequality, etc. But I think it's something that is a really interesting issue, you know, to hold up and to say what kind of identifications can we develop, you know, which in some ways provide possibilities of cross racial identifications. You know, I think that those are key questions which we should be asking.
I wanted to start by saying thank you. You find your passion for your subject contagious, and that's just wonderful to witness. And then two thoughts that came up for me. The one is a comment by a colleague who's also done a lot of work on race and the construction of racial identity. And she said, and I know you have an intuitive comment, very open, that we tend to look at the world through the lens of our greatest wound, and that the collective wounds of South Africa is around race, so that's the lens we focus on. And of course, that may then marginalize other issues of discrimination or prejudice or bias. And as a participant in a class on diversity about a year or two ago, where the focus was on race, although the topic was supposed to be diversity, what was really interesting, the feedback that came from students was that perhaps the class would have been more meaningful for me had it come in through a lens that was most relevant to me in terms of my personal experience of prejudice and discrimination, which may or may not have been about race, it may have been about sexuality or about gender. And so being able to take the theories of the construction of ideology of superiority and inferiority and apply them to my own experience of the most painful parts of my life experience would have helped me understand more about those other issues. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really interesting.
Very interesting. And also it's kind of interesting too how things like your common experiences of sexism or homophobia can provide identification because of cross race as well. It's very interesting. You know. And also, I'm thinking too in terms, you know, one of the things that emerged as well from the course last semester on race was thinking about tastes as you know, common tastes as ways of interests as ways of producing cross-race identifications, and the people were talking about, you know, sort of how space has become racialized on campus and in terms of music or in terms of and sport and things like this. So how tastes in some ways operate to preclude possibilities of cross-race identifications. And there's a wonderful ethnography which a sociologist and ethnographer called Martin Doby wrote in a school in Durban. It's a formerly white school, it's now presumably black. And she found that some people, when they identified themselves, they didn't identify themselves in terms of race, of course, you know, what would you say, what kind of person you are. They talk about themselves in terms of taste, like music or fashion or sport. But what she found, and she said, you know, this is kind of quite progressive, but on the other hand, she found that sport, interest in sports and leisure and fashion were highly racialized, you know, so that people who tended to, you know, like surfing or rock, you know, were usually with my man as well, and my then with Rock, and so she said, your race was kind of inscribed through taste in a way, and I was thinking it was a way we can go beyond that a bit, you know. And I know there's a really interesting, where some people spoke about developing. I mean, there's a poetry kind of reading group. I don't know if you know about it. Peter Odendahl and Adrian Marks Adrian Van Dyck rather, are here to help to organise it, and they have it in Kathmandu, and that's a really, really interesting kind of cross-racial group, actually, you know, and I think it's a wonderful example, you know, we should think about good practices here, actually, what's going on, which is really effective. Some people mentioned there was a meeting we had few weeks ago, not an open stand much more, but it's kind of it's held in Russell Bachman House just outside, and there's lots of interesting people there. And someone said, you know, why don't we have music events? You know, why don't we have a mixture of kind of rap and rock and house and, you know, very different styles, so we get people from different places together, you know, rather than entertainment producing these kind of differences.
Sorry, I was just going to say how much I enjoyed the talk and the discussion. I want to ask a little bit. You seem to be so good at humour. I mean, I'm unable to discuss anything academic without making a joke of it. But one of the things that really worries me is when students feel humiliated, and it's not most of it, but I find around discussions of things about race, it's very easy for students to feel humiliated. White students only, and black students. And I wonder how you, do you find that you're just going to humiliate students? And how do you manage the anxiety around it?
I mean, it's really difficult to do that because one of the things about humiliation is that it's very difficult to articulate that almost by definition in a big group. You know, I mean, people don't talk about being bullied in if you interview them in groups. You know, that never happens. It's almost like that reinforces the humiliation, actually. You know?
Yes.
So how do you deal? I mean, I've certainly had some students, you know, coming around to my room not actually complaining about the course, but they're just talking about other instances, you know, where they do feel humiliated and feel quite anxious in relation to this, and that's kind of happens. But also, we have a tutor system which is great in our course, just the last couple of years, our tutor system. And some of the tutors develop quite close relationships with their students, and something, you know, that we talk about in the course, you know, but I do think it's a very important issue to raise, and almost the invisibility of it, and I suppose what I'm trying to also, I mean, I do try to emphasize the importance of respect, you know, and that almost I sort of feel an obligation in the course to make it enjoyable and also to make it fun, and the last thing I want to happen is for people to feel humiliated. You know, and it's kind of make that sort of quite clear, I think, at the beginning. So, I don't know. It involves, I mean, humour is one part of it, you know, but as I said, you know, there's also the pain which people feel, and that really needs to be engaged with, it's the thing about, I mean, the face of race is not just two sides, it's the, you know, 101 sides, and we have to kind of bring them all together, actually.
Do you find that you
don't
share your experience with other people who aren't
I think it's difficult to do that, and you have to talk about that in a big group. It happens. I mean, it's more likely in a tutor group, and it sort of happens there, actually. Because I also take a tutor group, you know, but not in a big community. That doesn't happen. But what's, and that actually is why it's very important, you know, I think, to report on the search which has been conducted here. I mean, I mentioned the research about marginalisation in residences that some students experience, and to have a researcher read out examples of that, which resonates actually, where it turned out with experience for a number of particularly black women students in the Leicester Theatre. That's very important for us to do that. But I think it's, you know, it's very difficult for people to on their own to express that in a big way.
Any last questions?
Yes. If we accept that race was, let's call it colonizing used or used at a certain time in the history of this country and around the world, then surely the opposite, the deracialization, should be initiated to a large extent by generational followers, children of the same denomination affiliation. What I'm saying by that is we have many incidents post-94 of reconciliation which are largely non-attended, non-supported by the perpetrators of injustice before 1994. Either physically, and there we cannot see, which is in the minds of people. But I mean, our actions, as you said, it's an act thing. So it's fine to say that we support the new dispensation, the post-94 ideal, and what we're striving to get to. But it must manifest in personal actions, not just group ideologies and supports. And a nice statement we make when we're not at the right place and on that message. It becomes a very personal thing. And one of the speakers spoke earlier about not being accepted for being an African. It's beyond our borders. My question would be, are we accepted within our borders as Africans? And if not, why not? And how much are we personally at fault for not being accepted?
Thank you for the meaningful conversation, and Rob, thank you to you especially for not only talking about teaching race, but also about learning race, so that for all of us here, I'm assuming, but okay, speaking about myself, that it was also a time for thinking about how I learned race, and challenging my own conceptions about that, so thank you very much. This is a small token of thanks to you.